mean his voice already?
I'm recording this poetry in the studio of the college. It is a small studio we are in with Robert Duncan and Madeline Gleason present, which is necessary to explain the rather intimate character of the presentation. The poetry is several years old for the most part, and falls into that genre known as conversion poetry. But that much said, it's necessary to go on and say immediately that once having said that, you've said nothing. I mean, it has nothing to do about the poetry as poetry, and although it has a great deal to do about the psychological impetus behind the creative act, and unquestionably throws that impetus one way or another by virtue of the particular conviction of the poet. Nevertheless, the fact is that as poetry, the conversion stands a bit to one side, and the poetry emerges in its own coherence or lack of it in terms precisely of what the poet can make of it. The conversion, which again comes as the determining character of the ideational background, did not radically alter the sensibility of the poet. It merely gave it a direction that it had never in this particular poet's life ever gone. And while he reached back into his consciousness and grappled with the problems of the problem of what you form poetry out of, or how you render ideas in poetry, which can only be done in terms of the poet's sensory experience, so that whichever way the poet's fate takes him in life, whether it's to a greater and greater profanity or a greater and greater sacredness, to keep the balance there. Nevertheless, the only thing he can reach for is the ingredient of his experience, so that a poet who is a nature poet as a profane poet comes out indubitably as a nature poet as a sacred poet. It's plenty evident in the Bible itself, where all the rhetoric and the imagery is profoundly influenced by the natural environment in which the prophet, who is the equivalent in this case, in which the prophet wrote and spoke. So looking back at a conversion, one looks back at poetry he would never write again. That is to say, he could not possibly bring himself to utter these particular truths in this particular way. Sometimes it's embarrassing to him to look back at the poetry of his conversion, because he sees the psychological impact in it in terms which he no longer feels. He wears his faith naturally, and it's like an old coat. But when he looks back, he sees somebody decked out in such new and splendorous garments that he can only rejoice and exult in the great thing that has befallen him. So that note of exultance, of of psychological transcendence, you see, which has nothing really to do with the whole problem of faith, which did transform the poet's soul, that problem of faith is something the poet can never reach. It's a mystery, and it happened to him, and he celebrates it. But what he tries to celebrate, I mean, all he can do is to render the impact of the thing on his mind, on the psychological mechanism, to use the Freudian term. But the faith, you see, as something entirely deeper and untouchable. So he does look back at his conversion poetry with some, some inexpressible emotion, which perhaps he wishes he could recover that. Perhaps he wishes he could recover what he has to say, what he did say. Perhaps he wishes he could live forever in that transcendence of emotion that made his conversion the great thing it was. But that's not given to him. He would be a very limited person indeed if he did not go beyond that. And the more painful thing which he has to grow to tempers him, so that when he does come to look back, he looks back with nostalgia and, as I said, envy. But yet in his realism, he has to acknowledge that there has been, that there is a gulf between what he is now and what he was then. So the poetry. The first poem I wrote in the clear impact of the idea was the poem called Triptych for the Living. And it more perhaps than most of the poetry that followed, certainly as much, does draw on the immediate background of the poet, the natural background, seizing up all the elements of his associations and transforming them into a new direction. It is modeled after the triptych, which is in medieval art was that decoration which fronts up a pulpit. Pulpit being the shape of a hexagon, those three sides which face the congregation, one jutting out directly at it and two at angles back, so that often those were decorated with three pictures to make what is known as a triptych, and three scenes generally from the of Christ or of the Bible, of some character of the Bible. And I took on that. There is a part in the Mass right after the canon which is called the Diptych for the Living, and that idea in my newfound Latin, the thing that the Missal gave me, I toyed with that word. And when I came to, there were the diptychs for the dead, the remembrances for the dead that are given there, and I toyed with that. So when the title of this poem emerged as a threefold thing, I seized on that title of Triptych for the Living because of its religious associations, and of course the almost the irony there too, of the living rather than the dead, as it was, this man has come to life, a man who is dead has come to life, the Triptych for the Living. And later I chose a superscription for it, which is from Job chapter 14, verse 3, which reads, "And dost thou think it meet to open thy eyes upon such a one, and to bring him into judgment with thee?" The first part of the triptych is a poem called The Uncouth, and it is a poem about the shepherds in the Christmas story, the shepherds being those simple herdsmen who were on the slopes over Bethlehem. We hear it so often at Christmas time. Now as we record, we're in the first week of Advent, and all that great event is rising once again before us. The liturgy is, those of you who know it, is beginning to gather up from here and there. This, the prophecies by which the incarnation was to come, all that magical fabric by which the church chooses to keep before our eyes the tremendousness of that occurrence. And so we're in the season for it. The shepherds who are about to be the first recipients of this terrific news that is brought to mankind. And I drew back down into, I wrote this at Christmastide, and I drew back down into my consciousness. I have another it's a prose work where I describe something of the genesis of this poem in the San Francisco Cathedral the night of Christmas Eve in 1948, that was. And we saw the little shepherds there, the nuns had fixed the crib at one side of the altar, and There were the little shepherds there and the pine boughs, and I wrote about that, how there I saw one of the first inklings of my conversion. I was not yet a Catholic. But I went home from that, and I had made a correlation, and you will presently see what it is, because what we generally see as shepherds are certainly not what emerged from this poem. But it's that correlation that forms the gestation of the poem, the ingredient, and gave it its impetus. So I begin now on this poem, The Uncouth. A mild autumn, rain, and the high pastures greened again with good verdure. But at solstice wind north for cold, and they brought out the sheep, nights crippling, frost in the hollows at dawn, the wind blowing as out of the depths of a void, blowing as out of the nethermost places of earth. And on the third day, near dusk, being come at last to the wilderness edge, drew in their flocks, made nightfall there, the sheep herders, built weed fire, would go next day down to the valleys, warm, to the sheltered fields, a more tolerant winter. For the sheep only. As for them, the herdsmen, they'd rather hug out the year on the juniper ridge than enter now, where the hard-bitten settlers fence their acres, where the merchants wheedle the meager gain of summer, where the brindled mastiffs maul the weather. For the sheep were hated, themselves were hated, their ways were of sheep, they wore rough skins of sheep, and the stink of the sheep hung everywhere about them. And they made their weed fire gravely. This for them was the last night. Tomorrow was the world's, and the world disdained them. And they had no knowledge of the world, nor had they knowledge as yet of the angel. For these faces were fainted, the fire in its fletching dapple fretted the countenance of a humanity that had demonstrated only the crude capacity to survive, the brows hardly clefted by thought, where hope, as on the face of the ram, never had recourse. Something there was about to happen, as if a soul were to be bestowed, where the naked intelligence, that primed animal aptitude for life, retained its purity. And the world, of whom these the uncouth were most despised, mocked off the streets to keep the cold night watches there over the wilderness-hearted earth, dreamed blindly on of the transforming grace these were now to receive. The second part is, of course, concerns the birth, the incarnation itself. And of course that too made a terrific upheaval and overturn in my whole processes of thought. The physical man joined in the physicality of life, a man of direct carnal engagement, you might say. The sum of my past had been in that sphere of the carnal engagement, of the complexity of human soul and the human carnality and the act of the existence that is the man of blood and bone and flesh, to be brought forth, to be brought up short by the fact of incarnation and the virgin birth has to be settled somehow in the mind. The soul, of course, accedes to that at an entirely different level. I spoke earlier of faith, that great supernatural influx by which the whole character of the soul is transformed and the sublime mysteries are given to be seen in their cogency, where before all was outlandish and mythical. But yet the psychology has to be approximated. That's the thing. To be converted and inarticulate is hardly to be a whole man. And what does the poet do before a mystery like that, that has revolutionized his being? He has to engage it somehow. He has to approximate it somehow in the fabric of his art, to resolve it there. It's those two polarities that cannot be met except in terms of the mystery have to be reduced somehow to the texture of a living verse, that the mystery can be, well, not solved certainly, but at least stated somewhere near the complexity that, I mean, the Christmas story as it's usually tinkled out over the radio, I mean, that will not satisfy the intelligence. What do you make of it? What do you do with it? How do you come by it? How do you face up to it? That's what I mean. And so the poet, his way of facing up to it is in the complexity of his utterance. He goes down there, because if there were no difficulty there, he wouldn't write the poem. That's the whole of the matter. It's only in terms of his terrific solutions. He's searching in the depths of his soul for a solution to the problem that's tearing him apart. Here he is, a rational man faced with I don't say an irrational, but a super-rational event. And what's the rational going to make of it? So the poet drops down to another mode of being, which is insight, intuition, the depths of the creative intuition. That's where the poet goes. And in the depths of the creative intuition, where the mind sees in its density and complexity like it sees no place else, no, at no time does it see as it sees that. That's where the poet goes. That's where he meets his problem, and that's where you'll meet yours in your own way. But this is the way it's met then by the poet, the 20th century man faced with a mystery of those dimensions. This is the way he meets it. The Coming, this poem is called. Blood, that the black bull trodden earth, where the cow had bled of the womb-blind calf, where the shuddering ewe had bled, and the beast's fortuity, the beast grown. It too, it also, birth like death ravenous, an unspeakable rank fertility of earth splitting its paw. This time a difference. That lull in the air, that lapse, as if the great device of the flesh, the need of the flesh, made flesh. The flesh founded forever upon the flesh, blood on the blood, as if on the instant the stroke were checked and the flame sprang through purely between the forces of the pang, hued with the flesh of Godhead, set round with the tongues of angels, burning and flashing in the strewn litter on the somber floor. Nor would that night contain it. There was an age, insurgent, scrawled on the stonework of the temple wall. There was the massive aftermath, flanked with the doom of kings, and the secret seeds bored in the bowels of empire. There was the powerful regrouping of the mind, where the sotted puppets snored on their grosser thrones. That, and the bare power, which is love, forged now in the frighted human soul, as the force of a love larger than it swells the wizened heart to the stature of a faith. Birth, like death, transcended. The blood burned out of the stable floor. Outside, the oxen and the ass crunched their corn, but the man seized in that vortex, breaks on his knees and prays. And the last section of the triptych concerning the magi, and here called the wise, poem I wrote in a sense to draw across T.S. Eliot's The Journey of the Magi, for that was no conversion to me. So I wrote my own poem, and this is it. miles across the turbulent kingdom they came for. But that was nothing. That was the leaf, drunk with vision, rain stringing the ragged beards. When a beast lame, they caught up another and goaded west. For the time was on them. Once as it may in the life of a man, once as it was in the life of mankind, all is corrected. And their years of pursuit, raw-eyed, reading the wrong texts, charting the doubtful calculations, those nights knotted with thought when dawn held off and the rooster rattled the leaves with his blind assertion, all that they regarded under the sign, no longer as search but as preparation. For when the mark was made, they saw it, nor stopped to reckon the fallible years, but rejoiced and followed, and are called wise, who learned that truth, when sought and at last seen, is never found, it is given. And they brought their camels breakneck into that village, and flung themselves down in the dung and dirt of that place, and kissed that ground. And the tears ran on the face where the rain had. I'll go up in time now to a poem I wrote when I was at a Catholic worker house for homeless men, where 1,000 men a day were fed and 40 or so crowded into a small storefront to be find beds at night. And we lived there month after month with them, and this poem emerged from it. The first part written soon after I came there, the second part 9 months later, and a resolution. Hospice of the Word it's called. Morin House, 5th and Washington, Oakland. In the ventless room, over the beds at the hour of rising, hangs now the smother and stench of the crude flesh. And at the grime sink we fill the basin of our mutual use, where our 40 faces, rinsed daily, leaves each its common trace. Is it then in this alone then, that we find our oneness, who never in cleanliness, never in purity, have ever truly met? Oh, my brothers, each brings our sin-deformed face to the greasy pan. Is it not a terrible thing to come upon our lives here in each other, in the inalienable commonality of our grosser selves, and found there that sign and testimonial of our secret hearts? Could it not have been other, a true revealment of the soul's intent, a freer gift, welcome, and most dear? Far off, in clefted rocks and dells, the spring water throbs out the faultless pulse of earth, a loosened flow. And God's sheer daylight pours through our shafted sky to proffer again the still occasion of His grace, where we might meet each other. But the stain remains, ubiquitous, under the thumb, in the crease of the knuckle or about the wrist, or there where the lice suck leaves its tracing along the rim. As I too, at night undressing, my body, its odor lifts like a sigh of the utter flesh, the common breath of the poor. Could it not have been other? Moan of the scrupulous self, wrung outcry of the oppressed heart thrown back to God. But how else and where? Not in the urbane apartment, surely, the suburban mansions, nor the luxurious hotel. For in the crucible of revulsion, love is made whole. St. Francis ran on goose flesh toward the leper's sore. He saw his God. Improbable and rare, most priceless ingredient, it lurks behind the stubble beards, and night after night, under the hovering breath of hundreds, it is there. Then morning after morning, in the innominate faces soused at the shallow pan, that in this has become like the makeshift dish, seized up in haste without foreknowledge, that April afternoon, toward three, when the oblique lance upthrust unloosed the floodgates of the redemption. How many faces rinsed there might rise like mine from the bloodbath, almost whole? The bowl where Pilate damped his mincing fingers, and the immortal dish under the crossbeam merge here, where the Christ gaze focuses at whole. Of love, tortured and serene, it stares from the visage of all men unsanctioning its immense pity and its terrible grief. For there on the nail above the sink, where the townswoman's cauled linen, smutched, gives back the divine face. How many times each day is not that impetuous brow thrusted into my sight, saying always, not these, but this. Look, it is I. O Lord and Sacrificer, I turn to meet, but the dead sin of the inordinate self tentacles my heart. Take now my wrong. And very fast, a movement shifting forthright through the nimbus of a veiled withholdance, his look lances, and his unbelievable mouth, torrent of joy, pressed home, shudders the rapt heart. This poem is a later poem. It's written after a passage from St. Teresa of Avila. I think it's in her first book, or she's writing in her autobiography. She's writing of the graces, the mystical graces. And she writes, The Lord gives these faces. The Lord gives these favors far more to women than to men. I have heard the saintly Fray Peter of Alcantara say that, and I have observed it myself. He would say that women made much more progress on this road than men, and gave excellent reasons for this, which there is no point in my repeating here, all in favor of women. Annul in me my manhood, Lord, and make me woman sexton weak, if by that total transformation I might know thee more. What is the worth of my own sex, that the bold, possessive instinct should but shoulder thee aside? What uselessness is housed in my loins to drive the rampant pride of life, when what is needful is a hushed quiescence? The soul is feminine to God, and hangs on impregnation, fertile influxing grace. But how achieve the elemental lapse of that repose, that watchful, all-abiding silence of the soul, in which the lover enters to his own, yielding himself to her and her alone? How may a man assume that hiddenness of heart, being male, all masculine and male, blunt with male hunger? Make me then girl-hearted, virgin-souled, woman-docile, maiden-meek. Cancel in me the rude compulsive tide that like an angry river surges through, flouts off thy soft lip touches, froth blinds the soul gaze from its very great delight, outballs the rare celestial melody. Restless I churn. The use of sex is union, union alone. Here it but cleaves, makes man the feudal ape of God, all ape and no bride, usurps the energizing role, inverts, and in that wrenched inversion caught, draws off the needer from his never-ending need, diverts the seeker from the sought. Advent, fertile and rank and rich, the coastal rains walk on the stiffened weeds and made them bent, and stunned November chokes the cottonwood creeks, for autumn's end. And the hour of Advent draws on the small-eyed seeds that spilled in the Pentecostal drought from the fallen cup, swept in the riddled summer-shrunken earth. Now the eyes look up. Faintly they glint, they glimmer, they try to see. They pick at the crust, they touch at the wasted rind. Winter will pinch them back, but now they know and will not stay blind. But all creation will gather its glory up out of the clouded winter frigid womb, and the sudden eye will swell with the gift of sight and split the tomb.